There was a threat at my school. He threatened to stab 20 kids.
Students and parents air out their discontent over school safety. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Last night, dozens of students, parents, and staff shared their concerns. Most of the students don't feel safe in Broward schools. Superintendent Robert Runcy vowed to make things right. We'll learn more about last night's meeting. Next week, techies and those in the startup game will be in Miami for the Emerge America Summit. We'll look at one of the key topics of discussion, creating more opportunities for women in the tech field. And you've probably seen his gardens. Robert Jungles, yes, that's his name, is known for his tropical landscapes and gardens, many here in South Florida. He'll join us to discuss how he creates those unique Florida landscapes. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, a poll by the Pew Research Center just came out yesterday, and it found that a majority of U.S. teenagers are afraid they will become a victim of a school shooting. Last night, dozens of students and parents expressed concerns about safety in Broward County schools following February's mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman covered the often tense emotional meeting, and she joins us now in studio. Jessica, great to have you back.
Thanks very much.
All right, so give us some context. What was the forum billed as, and who did we know was going to be in attendance going into that? Who was there?
So I talked to Superintendent Robert Runcy earlier in the week, and he told me this forum would be an opportunity for the district to provide some informational presentations, brief, on some issues that a lot of people have had questions on. What are they doing on school safety, on mental health? There have been questions on discipline, and that the rest of the time would be for people to ask questions and provide feedback and ideas about how the district could move beyond and be better.
And who showed up? Who was in the audience?
It was exactly who you would expect. A lot of students, a lot of parents, a lot of people who work at schools. And I would imagine people in the community as well.
Do we know like what percentage came from Marjory Stoneman Douglas?
I couldn't give you a percentage. And obviously, you know, it depends on what you can kind of see in the audience. You know, the auditorium at Plantation High School was pretty full. But based on who got up and spoke, because each person who spoke identified themselves, a lot of the students that spoke were from Marjory Stoneman Douglas. There were some parents, at least one teacher. And then also people who were like, you know, I'm a parent in Parkland and I have a couple of kids who are in elementary school and middle school and will eventually go to Marjory Stoneman Douglas. But there were kids from other high schools and people, you know, from elsewhere in the district as well.
So they brought up a lot of issues, and one of the controversial issues that we've been following again about Marjory Stoneman Douglas are the safety precautions, specifically the clear backpacks now required for students. How did that play out in the conversation?
Well, one student in particular spoke on that issue. Her name is Angelina, and she's a senior. She said she's been seeing people get into school with regular backpacks despite the new clear backpack policy. On the other hand, she said she saw someone going in with a clear backpack and a lunchbox, and she saw a member of the Broward Sheriff's Office check the lunchbox. So she wanted to do an experiment to see what's happening. Is this policy being implemented consistently, to see if she would be stopped? So she brought in a regular backpack herself, and you can hear what she said during the forum now.
I walked past numerous BSO and other security, and I walked into school with a bag that was never checked. Someone who wants to do harm could have done the same thing I did. Why do we have clear backpacks if they aren't being enforced? And why do we have BSO everywhere if they aren't doing their job and seem to be hanging out around our campus?
So after that, a district administrator, her name is Valerie Wanza, she gave some information to the student. She said that the student's bags are checked randomly, which didn't go over so well with the audience. You can hear their back and forth now.
You currently have a clear backpack that was not checked, or you have one that is not clear?
I have a clear backpack, but I brought a side bag in to see if they were enforced the way they say they are.
So we don't check every single bag, every single...
So you pick and choose who you want to enforce
so
on.
So we have to have a randomized process.
Randomized. It goes through the random.
So we have to have a randomized process for how we search student property, but I will go back and work with the school's administration. I'll be there in the morning.
So in that, if you didn't hear it, let me just repeat it. She said randomized. Somebody in the audience yelled out, Nicholas Cruz was randomized. It did. That answer didn't go over well.
Yes, Nicholas Cruz was random. And I saw who it was. It was some students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas who I know from, you know, talking to them at different events since the shooting.
You know what we talked about? We've talked to Robert Runza. You've spoken to him as well independently. And we talked about the security measures at the school. But we've also heard from students who, they, you know, they're concerned about the security, the excessive security presence. And that was also brought up.
Yeah, the first student who spoke actually went to Douglas and said school has started to feel like a correctional facility. He said that the way the gates and the fences are locked, it's very difficult to move around campus. And it's really getting in the way of students learning and going to class and doing what they're supposed to be doing at school. However, you know, other people said the opposite. They said that there's not enough security. So certainly there are people on both sides of that issue.
Did you get a sense of where more people for more security, less security?
I think more people were for more security. I think that a lot of that was coming from people who aren't at Stoneman Douglas. I mean, so for example, there was a teacher who said, you know, there should be someone manning the gate every time it's open in the morning when students are coming in and the afternoon when they're leaving, that there wasn't enough security there. But then, you know, you had all of these other people coming up. Like there were two different people who came up and said, we've specifically reached out to the district and offered to donate like a $250,000 state-of-the-art security system, and no one's getting back to us. So you can see that there's this tension and there's this fear in the community where everyone's like, we need to do something about this right now.
And I wanted to ask you about, there's a specific incident that happened at Charles W. Flanagan High School. What was that?
Yeah, so two different female students got up and said that on April 4th, so 2 weeks before the forum yesterday, that a boy had threatened them at school, had said he was going to stab 20 kids. And they said they went to their administrators, they told them what was going on. They said that they were assured that, you know, the fact that they went to the administrators was going to be a secret, but then they came out of the office and he was standing right there, so he saw that they were the ones who told, and that ultimately he was allowed to remain at the school. So they were really upset, and they said that they've been reaching out to the district and trying to get help, and that no one had gotten back to them. And clearly, Superintendent Robert Runza didn't know about it. He was unaware. He said he was extremely upset, and that, like, he gave them his phone number. He told staff to give them his phone number and said, call me. We're going to follow up on this, but call me if you think that it's not handled properly.
So we don't know what's happened to this boy who's made the threats. Up to this point, he's still
in
school.
I don't know any more than what was said last night. But the fact that what I thought was really interesting about this, the incident, was that so many people used the forum last night as an opportunity to speak directly to the superintendent and district leaders. And over and over and over again, you heard them say, I've written you an email. I've called. I haven't heard back. And it was like some of the things they said were almost this like revelatory, like the superintendent and the administrators were surprised and were interested and wanted to hear more. And so there's like this disconnect where people aren't being able to talk to the administrators. And last night they were able to, and it was brutal.
Again, I'm talking with Jessica Bakeman, education reporter at WLRN. She was at that public forum last night with Broward County school officials discussing safety following the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. And as she said, students, parents, staff, all of them there talking with administrators, talking with the superintendent, Robert Runza, about their concerns. A lot of them don't feel safe in schools. And as I mentioned at the top, there's a new Pew Research Center poll that came out that showed that a majority of U.S. teenagers are afraid they're going to be a victim of a school shooting at some point in their school career. Going back to this forum last night, overall, I mean, you said that the superintendent felt a disconnect, that there's like a lot he doesn't know. Did he set an apologetic tone throughout, or was he listening and trying to find answers? What was going on with that?
Certainly he was listening and responding, and he was taking contact information and saying he was going to follow up. And he started by saying, you know, we're not going to get everything right. Please help us. Please give us, you know, your grace and your understanding as we try to, you know, move forward. One thing he did mention was this tense moment that had happened at a board meeting last week when Lisa Olson, she's a parent of Marjory Stoneman Douglas student William, who was shot. She said, "My son was shot. He will carry bullets in both of his arms for the rest of his life." But the district didn't reach out to see how he was doing, that when she was bringing him back to school, she actually had to show his x-rays to school officials to prove to them that he had been shot, you know. And she said that the president and the governor and all of these other people had time to come hug her son, but the district leaders and his principal didn't. And so Runcie addressed that at the forum last night.
Last week, one of the parents of one of the victims that have been shot reminded us that those families haven't received the kind of outreach that they should have. And they were right. We missed that. So we met with them this weekend. We're going to continue to make sure we connect with them. So again, if we miss something, let us know.
This is not going to be the last town hall. What's next planned? What are they planning for in the future?
Well, they announced that there's going to be an informational meeting on May 7th at Piper High School at 5:30, and that meeting is going to be on the Promise Program, which came up again and again during the forum last night. That's basically a program that allows for if students commit a specific series of misdemeanor nonviolent infractions that normally would end up with them going into the juvenile justice system or being in jail. There's this program that they came up with where those students are instead routed into these alternative programs where they get interventions. For example, if they have an issue with alcohol or substance abuse, they might get treatment for that. They'll get counseling. And so the idea of the program was to try to limit the school to prison pipeline and to have kids who could get put back on the right track to be back in school. But a lot of people are concerned about that. And so they're going to have an informational meeting to explain more about that program on May 7th. And then after that, they're working on an independent security threat assessment. And that report is supposed to come out at the end of July or the beginning of August. And they said they're going to have some more forums around that at that point.
One of the interesting points here, historical points, is that tomorrow marks the 19th anniversary of the Columbine shooting. And their students from Parkland who are headed out to Denver for that march. Their march is scheduled across the country, including thousands expected in front of the White House. But is there anything happening locally?
Well, I'm sure we can expect that there will be a walkout at Marjory Stoneman Douglas based on what some of the students that are more high profile now after this happened have been tweeting. I know that David Hogg, who's one of the students, has been encouraging everyone to walk out, even if you're not at school, even if you're at work. Whatever you're doing tomorrow, walk out at 10 a.m. because he says gun violence doesn't just happen at schools and we should be remembering that it happens everywhere.
Well, again, that's coming up tomorrow. That's happening tomorrow in a lot of places around the country. And, of course, if any of it happens here in South Florida, then we will, of course, be reporting on that. WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman joining us. Thanks so much, Jessica.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
And, by the way, more on that story on last night's forum is on our website, WLRN.org. Check it out. Still to come, Miami is about to host the Emerge America Summit. We're going to look at the difficulties that women still face in the tech world. That's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, women are increasingly playing leadership roles in the startup world. That rings especially true here in South Florida. Miami-Fort Lauderdale was recently ranked the top location for startup companies. Wynn Labs is a business accelerator program out of Babson College catered exclusively towards female entrepreneurs with visionary ideas. Michelle Labs is the director of Wynn Labs in Miami. She's also a speaker at the Emerge America Summit in Miami Beach coming up next week, the 23rd and 24th. The conference will feature dozens of tech leaders, the latest gadgets, a pitch competition, and a keynote speaker, Sophia, the artificially intelligent robot, which, by the way, I'm going to say we tried to get her for the show, and I'm still determined that one day I will interview a robot on this program. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. Such a pleasure.
Yes. Sorry that I have more hair than Sophia. I can't live up to that expectation.
No. It's not about that. She's a robot. It's okay. You know what? I mean, for people who don't know, just real quickly, what is Emerge America's conference? What is that exactly?
Yeah. So it's one of the leading conferences in the U.S. that brings together tech leaders all across North America, but also taps into tech leaders in Latin America and Europe. So we're thinking about, you know, how are we disrupting currently with the technologies and what are we going to do in the future?
All right. Now, I know one of the big topics, of course, is looking at women in the startup world, women in the tech world. So first, who are the female business leaders that are really changing the startup world right now?
Yeah. So I run the WIN Lab through Babson College, and we have 16 companies, all led by incredible females, and I think they are changing the game. We are really excited that many of them will be featured at Emerge, but a couple of them that I wanted to just share a bit about today, because I think they're really leading the way in thinking about how to make an economic impact and a social impact. That's a lot of what we are about at Babson. We're the number one school in entrepreneurial education for 25 years in a row. So we think about entrepreneurship in sort of the economic impact and the social impact. And so the females that we have in our program are thinking in that sort of dual mindset. And so one of the companies that will be featured at the event is Caribou, which is led by Max Tuckman. And that's an app that's really like a FaceTime meets Kindle. And the purpose of that is to connect parents who might be away from their kids and be able to still have that experience of reading to them. Because through the app, they can see each other and they can interact with the book together. So this originated from seeing a photo of a military man who was deployed trying to read, holding up this big book on a computer and trying to read with his kids. And so she created a solution that would allow the, you know, social aspect, the proximity.
She's one of the big speakers coming up at the at Emerge, right?
She will be there. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You know what I wanted to ask you though, real quick, just in general, mm-hmm. I wanted to get a sense of what are these entrenched biases in the startup culture, you know, that women are dealing with all the time? What is it you're running into?
Yeah, and that's what we're going to talk about at the panel. So the idea, you know, the hashtag that's out there right now, the future is female. We're really excited about that. However, what we see is when we look at unicorn businesses, okay, so businesses whose valuation is more than $1 billion, females are severely underrepresented. So in 2015, there were 84 companies out of this tech crunch study. Two of them were female entrepreneurs who owned those companies. So what we see is a dearth of female leadership at the highest level of, you know, sort of this unicorn valuation company. So we believe that we can change that if we first acknowledge what some of these biases and stereotypes are and then empower both men and women to fight against them.
What about you personally? Like, because I want to get a sense of what is happening out there. I hear the stories, but I mean, what have you dealt with? How do you help women deal with it?
So what we are trying to do is promote another version of what success in tech and in the startup world looks like, because part of where the bias comes from is that when you probably close your eyes, if I were to tell anyone on the radio right now, think of a successful entrepreneur, think of someone who's really has embodied success in the startup world. Likely you might conjure up an image of Mark Zuckerberg, or, you know, you're going to see this man first in your head. And probably, you know, from Silicon Valley, maybe techie, you know, younger, there's a real clear archetype that has been built around what that success looks like. And what we see is that plays out in an implicit bias. When we don't see the women there, then of course we expect, you know, the stereotype kind of comes through that we expect maybe women to not be as successful in that. And so we are fighting against that in empowering our women throughout our accelerator program. And then also having a space at Emerge allows us to help bring this issue to the forefront, educate around some of the research that's been done at Babson College. And how do we fight against that?
So you talk about what is that image? And yeah, as you were saying that, of course, I think about Zuckerberg, Bezos, you know, really it all goes back to Steve Jobs. So it's it's that white male, and he's probably dressed in, you know, a t-shirt and jeans, and, you know, that it's that. So, I mean, when you're working with women, is it about the image that they put out into the world, or are they trying to build an image, or is it, I mean, what exactly is it that you're doing, especially at Wynn Lab, to help them break through that? I don't want to say, I would call it like that, you know, that glass ceiling you're trying to break through, but how do you get to that point where one day we say, think of a tech startup, think of a big name in the game, and we could think of a woman.
Yep.
What is it going to take to get there?
Yeah. So what it's going to take is a whole heck of a lot. We are doing some, and we need people to support us and be part of this with us, which is, again, why I hope a lot of people come and, you know, hear the advice and the research and the knowledge that we're going to present to the panel, because what we are doing at Wynn Lab, I'm incredibly proud of, and we have a cadre of people who are supporting us. But if we really want to change the game to move that number of 2 out of 84 to parity, which would be, you know, 42 out of 84, then we need more people to support in this. So what we're doing at Wynn Lab in particular, it's an 8-month accelerator program. So women come in with a business that they've already tested a bit of the waters with. They've possibly launched the business already, or they're about to launch. And through our 8-month accelerator program, we help them launch successful, go to market successful, and scale that business up.
And one other thing too is this, are women getting the financing? Are the investors getting the money to these women in starting up their companies?
Not on an equal rate yet. And so part of what we do to address that is we build the knowledge base around the stereotype and how it plays out. So because the image that we conjure up is a Mark Zuckerberg, what happens then in the behavior and the actions of the investors, and this is found in a very recent study that Babson College just published, is that there is no bias based just on gender. It's not when they see a woman, they don't want to invest in her. But the bias is towards what they call male dominant behaviors. So the more calm, the more confident, the more bold you are, that is rewarded with a check. Women, on the other hand, who may be slightly more demure, shy, passive, or overly expressive. I mean, you guys can't see me on the radio, but I'm going like this with my hands. That's how I emote as a woman. That is not rewarded. That is not because of, you know, the way this stereotype and implicit bias plays out. That's not rewarded. So what we do is we empower, we share that knowledge with our entrepreneurs, and we give them some specific strategies to combat that in their pitches.
All right. So here's an interesting point. So you talk about, for example, let's say you have a Steve Jobs who was known for having a temper, very, you know, very outgoing personality, though when he gave speeches, he seemed, you know, kind of quiet. Mark Zuckerberg also seems like a very quiet guy. If a woman comes along and acts like either one of those two, that's a problem for her. Right?
No. So what the research shows is that when women exhibit more male behaviors,
yes,
they are more likely to get funded. So the way that, you know, women have to sort of change if they don't wake up in the morning and exhibit those, which many women do, right? So if you think of this on a scale, there's not necessarily, just because I'm a woman doesn't mean that I'm shy, right? Just because I'm a woman doesn't mean I'm going to be expressive, nor for males. And they saw this across males who, you know, are gender defined as a male. When they express more feminine behaviors, they were less likely to get funded.
I see. Again, I'm talking with Michelle Labs. She's the director of Wynn Labs in Miami. She's one of the featured speakers at Emerge Americas. That's a major technology summit connecting the United States with Latin America and Europe. It runs April 23rd and 24th. You know, I wanted to come back to Max Tuckman that you were talking about at Caribou. And you were describing this company. It's here out of Miami, and it is a unique company idea. It's a unique idea. In where they're at right now, as you said, it's a mix of what, Kindle and
FaceTime.
Mm-hmm. So, where is she? I mean, like, when you look at someone like her, you know, where do you see, like, I'm trying to get again this picture of what women have to do to finally break through that and become those leaders that we look to. So one day we could say, you know, hey, Max, that's the person we need to be like more like her. We need to find leaders like her. But what can you say about her specifically that makes her uniquely positioned, you know, to help other women right now?
Yeah. So I think it's on her and it's on Max and it's on all of us. So I just first want to acknowledge that, because I think part of what's going to enable us to get to this place where we have more equity is if we all take responsibility for seeing the shift. Max plays a part in that. And part of what Max does, she is a force. She is a character. I love her personality. She's a Miami born and bred Latino woman with her big hoop earrings, and she is unapologetic about that. And so I think she defies some of these, some of the research that we've seen and some of the stereotypes, and demands a level of respect, no matter what her gender is, no matter what her race or ethnic background is. And I think that's incredibly empowering. And we also have other companies who are very successful, who have founders and CEOs who have a different approach, who have a different personality. And I think they have a different role in how we shake this up and how we break the glass ceiling. We have a CEO who is much more soft-spoken. She has an incredible product. Her name is Susan Perry. Her product is called Speech Med. It is dictates and it reads your medicine prescription bottles to you. This originated, she lost her mother-in-law because she was not able to read the prescription. She had multiple medicines that the doctor prescribed. She couldn't read what was on the bottle, mistook what was on the bottle, and through that, fell severely ill and passed away. So Susan created a product that gets at this health literacy problem that we see in multiple languages, and it reads the prescription for them. Well, Susan is very soft-spoken. And she has actually gotten the advice from some investors and people who she's pitched to that it would probably be better if a man was at the front of this. And so the role that Max plays is different from the role that Susan plays, is different from the role, you know, we have many other companies that are part of the Wynn Lab, and everybody plays a different role. And I think what we do at the Wynn Lab is we educate and empower all of the entrepreneurs to understand what, you know, the stereotype is, what the biases are, and how you fight against that based on who you are personally.
The Women Innovation and Technology Summit is a major part of the Emerge Americas. The final speech is entitled "Men Still Explain Things to Me: The Post Me Too Movement." How has public awareness of sexual harassment and unfair treatment of women in the tech field changed day-to-day work for women?
Well, I think people are much more aware of it, and I'm so grateful for that. And that's why I think this is the moment to talk about this, because if there's a heightened level of awareness that, oh, maybe there were things, as if I'm speaking as a man right now, maybe there were things I was doing or there were pieces of my behavior that I didn't realize and they were unintentionally causing harassment. There are some also very explicit behaviors that we have heard about that have caused real harm and pain to women. And we've seen that come out through the Me Too movement. But I think there's a lot of other men who are taking stock and asking questions about their own actions. And that's part of what we want to capitalize on, is this heightened level of an ability to self-check and assess yourself. Let's the entire investor community, both men and women, let's commit to doing that. Let's commit to asking ourselves, am I asking a man the same type of question I would ask a woman? There's a ton of research around the fact is right now, no, they don't. Am I rewarding a type of behavior that is more masculine than, you know, someone who is more feminine? If we, you know, capitalize on this Me Too movement and the fact that people are, you know, owning up a little bit or a heightened level of awareness, let's use that then and direct that into action. You know, understand what the things are that we might be doing unintentionally and make the changes needed to drive towards equity.
You also mentioned briefly that, again, the goal for many women taking part in the Wynn Lab is to achieve, in part, unicorn status. Explain what that means in terms of financial motivation, but also world influence.
Yeah. I mean, if you are a company valued at $1 billion+, you have incredible power and influence in not only our own country, but across the globe. So I think as we move into the future and we see these businesses that are really shaping and dictating what our future looks like, it's incredibly important that half of the population who's underrepresented now become more part of that sphere of influence. And so many of our companies are seeking to get venture capital. And venture capital is incredibly important to get you to a place of $1 billion valuation. And what we see is only 3% of venture capital goes to women. And then if you cut that number of 3% down by women of color, it's like 0.02%.
And then add all to all of that, add what about social responsibility too?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, as women, part of the stereotype is that maybe we're more nurturing and you know, we are incredibly thoughtful about the economic impact and the social impact. And so I think having more women who are at this, you know, unicorn status to influence in a way might allow us to make connections on how we can solve key social issues and make money. One of the companies that we have that's doing that right now is called Lean Orb. Anastasia is the CEO of Lean Orb, and she's taking a real like system level approach to getting rid of all plastic pollution. So China recently told the U.S., hey, we're not taking your plastic trash anymore. This is a huge problem for us. There's nowhere to put it. So we need to get rid of plastic pollution. So she's created products that are plant-based products that are cups, silverware, plateware. And she's not just created the product. She's also looking at the system beyond that. So the compostable waste filtration systems that then recycle and fertilize. So this is a real system level approach to a social issue, but it's a business. She's going to make money. She's going to make a lot of money if, you know, we get investors and people to see the value of this. So we need more people like that at the unicorn level to help influence.
All right. I've got to ask you this, because I did mention at the beginning that, again, Sophia the robot's going to be there, and they're going to address the crowd, answer questions. If you get picked, what question would you ask Sophia?
That's a tough one. I wonder what her core values are. Like, what is most important to her when she's making decisions, right? Because if you think a robot, they probably don't have values. But she's got to have an answer to that. Where is she at? What's her operating stance? What matters to her? That's what I'd be curious about.
What do you think about the fact, too, that, look, a robot is programmable.
Right.
This is a female robot, or, again, designed to look like a female. But when we start creating robots, do we start adding those male or female traits that you were talking about earlier?
That's a good point. I guess it depends on, this is part of why I think it's important that we have both men and women in these development teams and in these high levels. So one of the first voice activation software was made by all men. So it literally couldn't recognize the voice of a female, right? So if the developers of Sophia the robot are right now at the, you know, kind of numbers of how many females are in development, which is way less than half, then yeah, they might be programmed with much more male dominant traits. And the question is, what does that mean, right? And so before we get there, let's make sure that we have more females at the table.
Real briefly, next Thursday is the graduation for this year's Wind Lab batch of students, but it's also a pitch competition, if I'm not mistaken. What are we talking here, Shark Tank?
I don't think it will be Shark Tank, maybe Dolphin Tank,
okay.
Just because we're Miami and we like the dolphins. No, so what happens in 8 months of working together and you know, going through the trudge and the celebration of being an entrepreneur, the group of 20 women have bonded in a way where I don't think they're sharks out for blood for each other. They support each other, and whoever wins that night, each of them will be excited for the success and the continued success of that venture. But we will see a little competition, right? Because they want that check. They want to take that home. But I hope you'll join us.
All right.
It'll be a fun night.
I appreciate the invitation. Michelle Labs, director of Wind Labs in Miami. Again, one of the featured speakers at Emerge Americas. Again, that's the 23rd and 24. Thank you so much, Michelle, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, still to come on the program, South Florida is a tropical place already, but we're going to meet Raymond Jungles, the man behind some of the most beautiful tropical gardens in the region. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, if you visited Lincoln Road or the New World Center in Miami Beach or the Key West Botanical Garden, you've experienced the work of my next guest. He's landscape architect Raymond Jungles, and he is renowned for designing tropical gardens and spaces all over the world. But he is based right here in Coconut Grove, and he is joining me in studio. Raymond Jungles, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed being here.
I appreciate it so much. You know what? I was reading about you. You did not grow up in a tropical environment. You grew up in the Midwest. Is it true you visited Florida once on some trip, on a spring break trip, and then all of a sudden, like, whoa, you fell in love with the place?
Yes. Actually, I was born in Omaha, Nebraska, with the last name Jungles, so I beat you to the punch of you asking if that's my real name.
Yes, I know.
Lived in Southern California, then back to Nebraska, then Illinois and Ohio, and then when I was 18, I moved down to Miami. And I did ride my motorcycle down here in my senior year of high school on spring break.
And then when you got here, I mean, coming from Omaha, even though you've traveled a lot, what was your first impression? You arrive in Florida. This is unlike any place in the United States.
Well, the beaches and the sky and the bikinis sort of caught my imagination.
And you decided, that's it, I'm going to go to school, because you ended up going to the University of Florida.
Yes, I went to Miami-Dade North and I got my AA degree, but I had to have a lot of prerequisites before I could get into the College of Landscape Architecture at the University of Florida.
All right, you know, when you finish school, you didn't do, I guess, like a lot of people, just backpack through Europe and do all that other stuff. You traveled to Brazil to see a famous landscape architect, Roberto Burl Marx. Tell us a little bit about him. Remind people of who he is if they don't know.
Yes, well, Roberto Burl Marx is known as the father of modern landscape architecture. He's an icon and a treasure of Brazil, and he was my mentor, and I did learn about him at the University of Florida. And the reason that I didn't take a job when I graduated from college was so that I could have the freedom to be able to travel to Brazil and receive his mentorship.
And you met him at the university. He came and did a speech, right?
I heard about him first in the History and Theory of Landscape Architecture book called Design on the Land by an author named Newton. And so that's when I first saw his Copacabana sidewalk murals and some of the beautiful work he was doing in Brazil. And then he came to lecture in 1979, and that's when I first met him, and that's started my whole idea of basically stalking him.
Yeah, no, I wondered, like, you know, at that point, you're this young guy, student, this is someone you admire, and you know this is someone who could teach you so much. How do you approach somebody like that? How did you approach him and make that connection?
Well, I went up to him after his lecture, and that particular summer I had obtained a job working for a landscape architect in Caracas, Venezuela, and I went to him in my naivety, and I said, I'm going to be in South America. Is there any way I could come down to Rio and see your operation? And he gave me his card and said yes. And shortly thereafter, I saw an article by Georgia Tasker, who was a great garden writer for the Herald for many, many years. And the article was named something like "The Maestro Turned 70. And at the time, he was doing a lot of work on Biscayne Boulevard. He was always coming through Miami. He had a lot of friends in Miami. And me being a 25-year-old at the time thought, oh my God, you know, he's turning 70. I better really get with this. So I started writing more letters, because this was before email, and I never heard from him. And then one day, Lester Pancoast, who is a well-known architect here in town, who also became a landscape architect and a damn good, can I say that, watercolorist, called me one day and said, Burl Marx is in town. Would you like to take him to dinner? Just like that. And that's how it all started.
By the way, you mentioned, because he does have some of the work here in Miami he's done. He did the, it was incomplete, and then it was neglected, the colorful sidewalk in Biscayne Boulevard.
Yes.
That was his.
Yes, it actually was. And I was able to work a little bit on some of the plant selection after I had graduated. Now might be a good time for me to say that you're going to ask me at some point in time what the favorite projects are I'm working on, I imagine.
Oh, I'm going to get to that. Okay. Yes. You're beating me to the punch. What, did you read my script? Okay.
No, but I wanted to say that such an honor right now. I'm working on an exhibition that they're going to have at the New York Botanical Gardens from June 9th, 2019 to September 28th, 2019, in which it's going to be a solo show on Roberto, and it's going to have his first large-scale horticultural exhibit, which I'm designing, and it's going to have a curated exhibition of his paintings, his fine art, of which he's as famous in Brazil as a painter as he is a landscape architect. He was basically a Renaissance man who was great at everything that he did, including singing, architecture, sculpture, you name it.
All right, let's get to, of course, you know, really just the heart of it all, which is, you know, so much of your work that you've done here in South Florida and really around the world. But let's talk about South Florida. And I'm curious, when we talk about Florida gardens, you've said that a Florida garden should be a Florida garden, not a Hawaii garden, not a Bali garden, not a Fiji garden. It's got to be a Florida garden. Why?
I believe that a Mexico garden should be a Mexico garden and a St. Kitts garden should be a St. Kitts garden. I think good design has to do with contextuality, and I believe that nature has developed a palette of plant materials for each region and a palette of building materials for each region, and it's the right thing to do to utilize that. It makes your job easier even. Your jobs will be much more sustainable.
So how do you define, if somebody asks you, what is a Florida garden?
Well, a Florida garden would be you'd primarily use native Florida plants from that particular region and ecosystem, because, say, for instance, South Florida has dunes, it has hardwood hammocks on rock, and it also has the Everglades. So you want to be specific to the type of ecosystem you're working with. But you wouldn't necessarily have stone from China, or you would use stone. We don't have much local stone, but we have concrete. So concrete, I like to say, is one of our local stones.
All right. I wondered if how many times, because I'd imagine it's happened before, that you would be working on a project for someone and they want something, and you're thinking, no, that's not part of this landscape. It shouldn't be there. I mean, any stories like that? And how do you talk people out of it?
Well, fortunately, the people who generally try to hire me are people that share my aesthetic sensibilities. So I'm not getting calls from people who want braided topiaries by their front door.
You hate topiaries.
No, I think topiaries in the right place with the culture that gardens in Italy. That's part of the whole language and the culture. I'm not against that whatsoever. I do hate ficus hedges in Florida for many reasons. But first of all, they're sterile. What I really resist is sterile gardens. If you plant native plants, and you'll have the butterflies, you'll have the birds, you'll be attracting the local flora and fauna, and then you'll have a live garden that's actually contributing to restoring some of the nature that's been displaced by human development.
Yeah, one of the other interesting things, too, is, you know, people talk about trying to make their yards or their gardens more native because... you know, this is Florida. As you know, we have all of these suburbs and all of these communities, and it's these pristine lawns. What are your thoughts about having that kind of setup, you know, where we're trying to create an environment that may not be natural to the area?
Well, I have a subversive mentality on that. All the projects I do in the urban areas, I try to use as many natives that would have been in that region as possible so that they become the seed bank for the birds, and then they start popping up. And I think that there's too much land that's totally cultivated in the city, that there should be more, like Coconut Grove, which is where I live, that is more or less left alone. Perhaps there should be more removal of exotic and invasive species, but you plant a plant that has a seed that the birds like and the squirrels like, and it's going to start showing up within a certain radius of where you've planted it and on into the future.
All right, you made an offhand remark in one of your books, just a sentence, that you bought a pair of rare palms from a collector who was selling them so that he could acquire a breeding pair of Komodo dragons. I got to hear this story.
Well... That's a true story. And I want to say that I am a plant nut. I do use plants from other parts of the subtropical world that are appropriate for here that aren't invasive species because they provide botanical interest and scale. And a painter wouldn't want to restrict his palette too unnecessarily. So I wanted a cup. There was very little planting area in front of a particular beautiful residence that we're doing, and I needed something that had some large scale, something that would be a foil to the scale of the architecture. And we found some South American oil palms, some atalayas, that a palm collector had on his big, large property up in Davie. And this gentleman wanted to sell some of his special plants so that he all of a sudden became interested in breeding Komodo dragons. And he bought a couple of really nice Komodo dragons from the sale of those two trees.
The things people bring, I swear, I tell you. I want to talk about some of the work that you have here in South Florida. People have probably seen and didn't realize, or just they pass by and they don't think about it. Work on Lincoln Road, the Fairchild, the New World Center. But, well, you know, just real briefly, tell us a little bit about some of those projects so people at least start to remember when they pass by, they know what they're looking at.
If you're in Coconut Grove, you'll see the Twisting Towers. That's called Grove at Grand Bay by Bjarke Ingels, the firm Big out of New York. We did the gardens there and the planting and the podium and the hardscape design in collaboration with him. If you go down 27th Avenue, where Aviation and 27th Avenue come together, we just did our own studio there. We renovated a building which actually happened to be designed and built by Lester Pancoast. Serendipitous moment, the guy who got me really hooked up with Roberto. Of course, Miami Beach Botanical Gardens, the New World Symphony, we did the roof and around the buildings and along the streets. Of course, West 8 did the park because of a little spat between the city manager and Frank Gehry. We did the Fina District. We did the Fina House. We did the Soho Beach House. We did the Fina Hotel. We did the Fina Arts District. So that's one of the things we're really happy about, because we were able to do 3 blocks of beach walk along the beach and bring all those native plants through the whole district, and which is similar to what we did at 1111 Lincoln Road, where we brought plant species from the Everglades into the city, which was a historic Morris Lapidus block that then was torn down and the road was open to traffic again. And my client, Robert Wenet, hired Herzog and Demeron, the Swiss architects, and myself to rethink the plaza. And we did that as well as the penthouse on the roof. And now there's an extension, 1111 extension, where there's a new, we actually did the interior of a restaurant, Choto Mate. And we did, as I said, maybe Soho Beach House, the Confidant. We did some work at the Eden Rock when it became Nobu. I know I'm forgetting things, but we did the pool deck of the Apogee, the renovation of that.
And just to mention that the 1111, that's the place with the fancy garage, I think it is, over in Miami Beach, right?
That's correct.
Okay. You know what? I wanted to ask you this. I don't want to let you go without asking you. You know, one of the things that we talk about a lot in South Florida is the fact that, you know, here sea level rise is an issue, and we see that water encroaching a lot more. And I'm just wondering, for you, you know, how is that affecting the way you design gardens, and what are you thinking about the future?
That's a very good question. I like to say that when I was in school, I had a geography class that I found out that every 20,000 years, there's either an ice age is receding or coming back on, and I realized that it's inevitable that something's going to happen with the level of the sea. At one time, the Virgin Islands were connected by land to Puerto Rico when the sea level was 200 feet lower than it is right now. I have to say that I do an awful lot of properties on beaches and on shorelines, on lakes, very prone to seawater level rise. But not only that, because we get saltwater inundation from tropical storms and from hurricanes. So that's why you want to use the plants that can take the salt tolerance. And then you will be able to have a much better success rate. And I'm hoping that humans will be able to figure out a way not to destroy the planet. But sometimes I'm a very optimistic person. Sometimes the situation seems bleak.
Let me finish with this. Just want to know, because I'm getting back to your name. Do you believe that someone's name can predict their destiny?
Evidently.
Your real name is Jungles.
Yes.
It's Jungles.
Yes. And the interesting thing was, when I was young, I wanted to be a mountain man and a forest ranger and live out in Colorado or Montana, but I ended up being more like Tarzan.
Again, I've been talking with landscape architect Raymond Jungles. His newest book, right, the newest one is The Cultivated Wild. He's got a bunch of books. They are absolutely beautiful to look at. So you know what? We'll have information on that on our website on the Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. Raymond Jungles, it's been a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
That's the program. Guys, have a wonderful weekend. Have a good Friday. We'll talk to you next week.